Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This is a special April 2015 Cider Sessions show. I got American Fine Cider Movements in town. I got Field Maloney from West County in Massachusetts and Lulu from Farnham Hill in New Hampshire. They're doing a special tasting at Murray's Cheese Bar this week. Got a lot going on in the world of cider, and I'm really proud to be capturing it here on Beer Sessions Radio. Thanks to our supporters, Union Beer Distributors, supplier of world-class ales, lagers, and ciders. I'm Jimmy from Jimmy's Number 43 in the East Village. All right, you can also follow us on Twitter at @beer_sessions. There's a lot going on in the world of beer and cider here on Beer Sessions Radio. All right, so Field Maloney, West County, and Lulu. Is it Lulu Wood?
No, Spencer, actually. It doesn't necessarily pay to be a Wood in Lebanon, New Hampshire, so I held on to my old name.
We got a lot of bases to cover, but what I like about having both of you here is that you have probably two of my favorite ciders in the world, and you're made in the Northeast, and we've known each other for a while through things like Cider Week and everything. But
we're two of the oldest cider companies. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little about that. So Phil, tell us let's pop some of these corks, and we'll taste and talk as we go. Tell us about how your family started up making cider. Because not too long ago, people thought cider was for kids.
Yeah.
Hoppa. Whoa.
That's a force.
Whose cider has more pop behind it?
Depends on the batch.
Yes, it's a little bit handmade that way.
It's going to take me a little...
I do. I mean, we've had a lot of shows. We've talked to your husband, Steve Wood. Mm-hmm. We've had a lot of shows talking about cider, that it's orchard-based, agriculture-based.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, and that's really, I'd say, what we're really about. We're calling it fine cider for now because people know the phrase fine wines, and we're trying to get that across. But really what we're talking about is orchard cider, that the beautiful fluids that... the tasting at Murray's Cheese Bar will feature are all made from juices that come from specific orchards and have specific varieties in them. And that, of course, is a minuscule fraction of what the American cider market looks like now. Because, you know, you have everything from the mass market to our snobby little handcrafted things. And we need to be noticed because it's a big world with a lot of noise in it.
And also, I think... It's sort of...
The
focus is on what the orchard gives you and working with that. Like, a lot of ciders is just sort of concentrate and water and sugar. And I think that most of us are coming from an apple-growing background, and it's sort of like the cider is made in the orchard, and you're trying to really see what you can do with the land and the fruit. And... You know, it's sort of grower cider, and it, you know, rather than just mixing some concentrate and water and sugar, which isn't to say that I think that I don't respect that kind of cider too, but we're going for something that really brings out the essence of the fruit from a particular place, grown in a particular way, you know, in a particular vintage. I mean, I think that's the other thing people don't. Thing about cider, like beer is, I think, much easier to make the same batch. Cider's much more like wine, where every year you can have the same fruit and or the same orchard, and the cider is going to be different just because some years the sugars are high, some years you get more of this flavor, more of that flavor, and so it's this incredibly... part of what's cool about it is it's not uniform. That every Farnham Hill cider, West County cider, is going to, you know, over the years is going to be different because it's going to be an expression of the orchard and the land at that specific vintage, that specific harvest.
Let's talk about the old days. So how did you guys start West County?
Because I've heard about it for a long time.
Yeah, my parents, when they were...
this is my breakfast. It's a Sunday. Sunday in April, this
it's
is my
good
breakfast.
For you.
Did you know John Quincy Adams ate 2 tankards of cider for breakfast every morning? And he did all right. But my parents had made wine. My dad was in medical school. This is back in like 65 or 66. And my mother, and they were living in San Francisco and then in Berkeley. And my mother was going to Berkeley. And they had a friend who had a vineyard in Carneros, which is in the south of Napa. And this was before the whole Napa wine thing got going. And they would go up and make wine with him. And then when they were living with a bunch of other medical students in Sausalito, and there was this old barn, and they met this old paisano who grew huge bats of Zinfandel grapes, and they made their own wine. And then my parents moved back to the East Coast in like 1970, and there was you couldn't grow grapes there. But even though we haven't, you know, cider's just hit the public consciousness in recent years. Out in the country, New England orchard country, you know, Massachusetts orchard country, there were still a lot of people making cider, mostly with sort of an old farm tradition. So they sort of saw this farm tradition, and they liked, I think my dad wanted to figure out a way to make his land sustainable, so he's, you know, we're grow something. And so, like, gradually, it was all forest, and gradually we cleared the land, planted an orchard. Our orchard's quite small. Started making cider. So they made cider for themselves in the 70s, and in 1984, I was in, like, fifth grade, we became a bonded winery. So this was our 30th year of production, was 2014. And I think my father's idea was, here's this fruit and this incredible drink that no one's paying attention to, but it's the local drink, and if you apply sort of winemaking techniques to making cider, and so we did that, and for the first 2 decades, as Lulu can tell you too, like, now it's, people are interested in cider. Cider's getting, it's not as hard to get people to try cider.
Right.
In the 90s.
Oh my word.
It was hard to get people to try cider, but we kept pushing, and it's been very gratifying. My father died 5 years ago, but it was nice before he died. There had been 5 years of cider, sort of this dream that he had had, that he was pushing, but for a long time there was this immense sense of just sort of crying in the darkness, you know, like, try cider, try, no, I only want beer, I only want wine. And this thing that he and my mother had sort of pushed was sort of taking off and leaving house and flowering, so that was good that he got to experience that, and it's only sort of flowering further. And that the American fine ciders is neat because it's partly a collective, because we're all friends who've been making cider for a long time and have sort of advised each other, tasted each other's ciders. So
let's go back. So where in Massachusetts are you?
We're in Coleraine, which is hard up on the Vermont border. It's on the edge of the Pioneer Valley in the Berkshires. So, like 45 minutes due north of Amherst in Northampton.
Did you
so
have
way out in the woods?
Were there already a lot of wild or whatever heritage cider trees there, or did you have to graft or plant? And tell us that process of developing your orchard.
Well, our orchard, basically what happened, we started planting in our first block, we planted in 86. Because the only fruit we could get was just the standard orchard fruit, like Max, Cortland's. And there was all this lore, but even though there were still people making cider here and there, like a few old farmers making cider here and there around us, like most of the old trees had been lost, and most of the knowledge of this tree is good for cider, that that tree is good for cider. No one really knew. And so my father and mother read a lot of the old books from the 1800s about where they would have reports on this was supposed to be, you know, the Tremulous Bitter was supposed to be a great apple, or the Dabinet, or the, Reine de Pomme. And so what they did partly was, there's an orchard, it's written about in Botany of Desire, if in the apple section, which is a wonderful book, the apple section, highly recommended. But there's an orchard in Geneva, New York, that it's part of like the Cornell Ag School, and it is the largest collection of apple varieties in the Northern Hemisphere. They have something like 30,000 apple varieties. And so my father knew one of the guys who worked at that orchard. And so he went walking through that orchard, cutting, because apple trees aren't planted from seed, you graft them. So like an apple tree is basically the same tree. It'd be like if you cut off someone's arm, stuck it in the ground, it would still be, there's no section, it's cloning.
Yeah. You could do that for baseball pitchers.
Yes, yes. and so we-
I bet you're all Red Sox fans.
I'm a Red Sox fan, well, she's a Yankees fan.
No, I'm actually kind of fatigued with both of them.
Good hand.
Orioles.
Chin-chin, Orioles. but so you cut off what's called scion wood, which is little branches. So he went with this guy who worked in that orchard and cut off about 50 different varieties of different trees that were supposed to be good for this reason or that one. One of the ones I'm most proud of is the Redfield apple, which is now being grown across the country, but it was no one had planted it. It was totally forgotten in the corner of the Geneva orchard. And they were like, this tree is cool. It has hot pink-red flesh. Like, it's really wild. And my dad's like, oh, I'll try planting a few of those. So our orchard was basically a test orchard in that it was about 50 varieties on planted. The first block was about an acre. So it's not like, it's like, look, a few trees here, a few trees there. And the thing was, we would kind of see, oh, I really like this one. And then when we really liked it, then we'd go plant more of those. And so, you know, we're still sort of planting to see what we think makes incredible cider. But we also have these trees that, like, we'd started off planting 5 trees. And then, you know, it's a long time because it takes, like, 7 to 15 years, depending for... between planting a tree and the fruit coming, you know, in any number. But it was, so we planted all these trees and gradually said, oh, I really like the cider that comes from this one, or I really like the cider. So like the Redfield, we've got 1,500 more Redfield trees coming next spring. So it's like...
Let me jump in on that one. We got some of your ciders this winter, and yeah. I have the Redfield. So tell us, I mean, the color of the juice was also like a pinkish red.
Right, because it's like the flesh is so, the flesh is beet red, and so it, like the juice is this hot, hot pink, and even when it's fermented, it stays this reddish color. It's really wild. It's kind of one of those fun party tricks to be walking through the orchard with someone who doesn't know the Redfield and give them an apple and say, take a bite, and then, because it's quite tart too, like, as Louisa can tell you, like... Sometimes the fruit that's the best for making cider is a little intense, maybe too intense for, you know, it isn't like eating a Red Delicious or something. It's like your mouth kind of gets overwhelmed with tannins or with acid and
oh yeah, I mean cider apples would make the pies from hell. It would be an evil trick to put it in a lunchbox. There's bad tastes there.
Some cider apples are good.
Oh yeah, that's true. No, there were quite a few.
But there are definitely some real funky ones.
Yeah, we call them crossovers at the farm. You know, if they eat well and they cider well.
Yeah.
If there aren't a lot of them.
Lou, since we're talking to you, tell us when you first met the Maloneys and well, West County.
Well, I
cider
think it
people.
Was we were they were ahead, certainly much earlier than we were in getting into cider, because we had a wholesale orchard selling into the grocery market, and that made less and less and less sense. But it took quite a long time to kind of wake up and realize that the best Macintosh in the world, we're not going to keep our place afloat. So,
but Steve, you had lots of experience. They have lots of experience growing
with
apples.
The horticulture.
They
yeah,
have been growing
yeah,
apples for what?
Oh, yeah.
Well, Steve 50 years?
No. Oh my God, no. Nope. Steve kind of got sucked into it. He's the first generation. We're the first generation to be growing apples on that land. And the backstory of that orchard is too weird, right, I think, to go into. But what ended up happening was, for a while there, we had this, you know, crackerjack Macintosh coming out of this sort of the northern limit of where you could safely grow Macintosh and get them really hard and crunchy, which Macintosh are not known for. And so we used to be able to get premium prices when there was any differentiation in the Mac market. But the whole commercial grocery apple market started to flatten and then just die for the New England growers for a host of reasons. First, it was a huge offensive on the beautiful, bright, waxed red delicious from the West Coast, and people were so much more interested in what looked good under fluorescent lights in the grocery store than they were in flavor that Macs got kind of beat up on. Then came the Granny Smith from
China.
The Southern Hemisphere. Well, no, China. China wasn't even a thought then. No, the China thing is much more recent, but first it was South Africa, Granny Smith.
Right, the Granny Smith.
New Zealand, Granny Smith. And they come, of course, they're fresh in the middle of our winter because they have the opposite seasons to ours. So that was bad. So every way, Macs were getting beaten up and our prices were just dropping. Then they said, make them bigger. Then they said, wax them. And we thought, we can't make them bigger, and waxing ruins them. So we had to look further. So we planted a whole load of heirloom apples, which look funny, taste fabulous. And we did pretty well with those at very high prices for a while. But then we took the next step in the 80s and planted 10 acres of apples that are inedibly tannic and bitter and weird. And
we're after a great start with the show. The first cider we're drinking is the West County Macintosh. We'll be back in a few minutes and we'll talk more about cider on Beer Sessions Radio.
Okay.
In 1996, L. Knife & Son acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn, but has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Union Beer has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Kings County, Brooklyn, through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education on all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the 14 counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio and the Heritage Radio Network. This is a special show with American Fine Cider Movement, with Louisa Spencer of Farnham Hill.
Farnham Hill Cider.
And Field Maloney of West County Cider. So, Lulu, you were just talking about how you guys went from growing, eating fruit.
Max and Cortland's and McCown's.
To cider fruit.
Yeah.
And one thing, Phil, tell us about this cider, because you actually are making a fine cider with
Macintosh. I'm proud of our Mac cider, because I feel like Mac was sort of the wisdom among cider makers. I would say that the word on the street is that Mac makes no good cider. Like, and we've made a couple Mac ciders for the last probably 10 years, but in the last couple years I got sort of into it because there's an orchard, a Mac orchard, that it's really old trees, and we pick them really ripe, and you get a lot of nose, and you get I've really ended up loving our Mac ciders, even though we grow like that test orchard I was talking about. Like, we grow Dabinets, Rendapalm, we grow these very tannic, so we're sort of have a foot in both worlds where I was sort of delighted with how these Mac ciders came out, and we're probably going to continue to make them.
Lulu, did you guys ever try to make a cider with Macintosh?
Oh, yes, we did. We would have been, you know, if we had figured out how to do it, life would have been a lot more straightforward, but we could not figure out how to do it, certainly in the time we felt we had. And we had all, we had kind of committed to diversifying our crop mix already, because we had planted a whole bunch of kind of colonial era apples and English apples from 300, 400, 500 years ago.
What are some of their names?
Well, okay, so, you know, we had Ashmead's Kernel, which a Dr. Ashmead in Gloucester had discovered in, you know, 17 whatever. And,
whatever.
That turns, and that turns out to make an absolute killer, super sharp fermentation batch, which acts as a sharp for us. You need high acid, high tannin, and high sugar to make a good balanced cider as far as we're concerned. The fact that he can do it with McIntosh is, as far as we're concerned, magic. So in our unmagic way, we have a wide range of different.
They're magical, apples. Don't believe in them.
Partly from having been through this grocery phase with the heirloom apples. So, for example, Golden Russet, which is a colonial apple. George Washington would have been chewing on a Golden Russet sitting on his white horse.
Wonderful apple for
everywhere.
Eating or for
yeah, exactly.
Or
that's
or
the
or
thing. It's like the Swiss Army knife of apples. So so it makes it, for our bases, and it's kind of a great middle fruit for a lot of our blends. And we had a lot of those for the grocery thing, and we're planting more. Asopus Spitzenberg, same thing. Thomas Jefferson loved Asopus
Spitzenberg. That was his favorite apple.
It was his favorite apple, but he couldn't grow it. Why? Because it was a northern New York apple originally, and it refused to live in Virginia.
I also heard he wasn't as good a farmer as people think.
Yeah, right. Or maybe he, yeah, it was more about writing about it than doing it. But still, you know. But he, anyway, he was right to love this apple. I mean, you bite into it and you think, TJ had great taste. But
yes.
But the problem was, of course, for him, he couldn't grow it. We can grow it beautifully. And
they are really, like Farnham Hill, Steve's been growing for a really long time, and they're like the Golden Russet. I find a really difficult apple to grow, and Steve is sort of a difficult, you know, an apple whisperer of these tricky varieties to grow.
But they are a giant pain. I mean, if you were picking them at regular market prices, you would never grow them because
right.
They don't fruit densely. Right. They're not efficient. You know, if you're trying to eke out a grocery store margin, forget it. That's why nobody's growing them in any bulk.
And I want to say, in terms of like early years of when I was probably in like maybe 12 or 13, I remember my father saying, "Oh, there's this guy Steve Wood who's planting," I think I had somehow thought it was 60, but it was 10 acres, which is a huge amount of heirloom apple trees. And he was so, because it's kind of like, at that point, most growers would think that was totally insane. Do you know what I mean? Like and now it's been this really visionary thing that, like, and the heirloom fruit that Lulu and Steve grow not only makes their ciders, but actually is in a lot of the artisanal ciders going around the country, because very early on, before anyone, you know, both of us were sort of trying for cider when it still seemed insane.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the insane people got together. I mean, I can remember your dad would come. We borrowed like this.
Yeah,
thing
very.
The crown capper or something. They were always trucking back and forth with shared.
And we get fruit from you.
We have over the years,
made ciders from their fruit. So.
Right.
So there's been that. That was one of the nice thing about cider.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's. I hope it's going to be able to stay. But there was this true spirit of camaraderie.
Right.
Early cider makers, and definitely the ethic was more help each other. Definitely like some friendly competition. Like everyone's wanting to make a good cider and have other people. But there's a strong sense of. Yeah, just helping each other in all kinds of ways, and we've definitely
because
we're only about an hour and a half away, but.
Right? And it's when you started,
you got to meet a few of the other cider makers who are now you're calling it the American Fine Cider Movement.
Kind of, we are.
Well, the invitation for the tasting.
Yeah, that's what we said. We called it American Fine Ciders, but we're not. I guess it's a movement. That makes sense, I guess.
It is a movement.
We've gotten shelled by some people for the phrase fine cider. Some people say,
you did a tasting last summer. You're doing a tasting this month.
I know. But it's,
so who's in the group right now?
Oh, okay.
You're a long time.
They're
all orchardists, right? They're all growing their own apples.
Although a couple of them are are buying in apples the way a winemaker would, with enormous discrimination and discipline. You know, not everybody grows everything they need. But so what we're calling orchard ciders are ciders that are based on intense discrimination in the choice of apples from particular orchards. So, for example, some of our juices go to people who just don't grow what we grow, but they can't get them anywhere else, and they wouldn't get them anywhere else. So that makes their cider an orchard cider, just by definition. You know, it's not as though they're going on the open market for it. So anyway, I'm going to go in alphabetical order: Eden Ice Cider, Northern Vermont.
Northeast Kingdom.
They make this celestial ice cider. We don't even like ice cider, but we like theirs. I mean, it's what angels drink, honestly.
It's really beautiful.
Yeah, and they do it by sticking the tanks outside and letting their horrible weather freeze the stuff. And then it's a long process, and I won't go into it, but it's magnificent what they end up with. And then we have...
And they're making a dry cider now with champagne-like... In other words, I think they're pretty much the only one in the group. Maybe, I don't know, but they're doing what's called a dosage, where you have a fermentation in the bottle.
Oh, no, Eves does that.
Autumn and Esmer,
they do that as well. Yeah,
just kind of special.
Yeah. Okay, so going in alphabetical order then, there's Eves Cider, which is upstate New York. And they have a lot of weird varieties, and they do straight method champenoise, and they do a beautiful, beautiful job. And that's all I can say about them, is that they are leaders in New York State. They're a lot younger than we are. I mean, what has happened over the years is that people have called Steve up when they're thinking about going into cider, and he's told them, yeah, do it, and here's how you do it. And we've sent them cyanwood, and people, a lot of our wood, our DNA from our test orchards, goes off as little sticks to other people's orchards, and they make their own trees, and they plant their own trees, and it goes on.
Yeah, that's
there.
Part of the cool, like in terms of the ethic of camaraderie, the funny thing is a lot of our orchards have partly come from sending sticks to, or getting sticks from other cider makers and other growers. Like I just sent Diane, who's Lulu's about to talk about, but she got 50 redwood, she's top working 50 redfield trees. So that
oh, really?
Was, so
That's
I sent,
fun.
Him, sent down to her just a couple weeks ago, but it's sort of neat to see.
Yeah,
this,
yeah.
It's sort of like a lot of cross pollination.
Yeah, and it's worth knowing that their Redfield DNA is going to grow very differently in Virginia. I had the weird experience once of needing one of Diane's pictures of, I forget what it was, one typical looking apple. We thought it was typical looking. Her picture of it didn't look like anything like our picture of it. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do? It wasn't as red, it wasn't as small, it wasn't as, you know, a lot of things. And it tasted different, so her ciders are automatically different regardless of whether she's using the same apples or not. You know, and so that whole terroir thing that people go on about in wine is entirely true of cider,
it's
too.
It's real, it's real. Yeah. I mean, you can even, I noticed, like, we made a couple different sort of single orchard max last year, and markedly different quality. Not quality in terms, they're both really good, but an orchard 2 miles away, two different orchards 2 miles away, slightly different exposure,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, all the sort of whatever the mysterious thing that makes the DNA of an orchard, but the fruit and the juice came out very differently. So that's just 2 miles away. So there's this, like, it's not just a marketing fantasy, you know, the idea of terroir
like
and orchard.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the fact is, you know, it's true of artichokes. It's true of every crop that there are conditions that alter the kind of in the chemistry of that crop wherever you plant it. Anyway, I wasn't very far down the list. Okay, F.
But wait, let's talk about this cider. So now we have a Farnham Hill.
Farnham Hill.
It is delicious.
Extra dry.
Yeah. Well, okay, F is Farnham Hill. That's us. We've been in the orchard business a very long time, and I think one of the things that propelled us into cider making was
Doesn't
just...
Doesn't sound good on the radio.
I don't know. I haven't heard it on the radio. We were not going to grow houses, as so many of the New England orchardists that we knew had. Guys who were second and third generation were walking around on land that was worth tens of millions of dollars, with developments all around them, and they were growing max profitlessly, and it just kind of got embarrassing. So big orchard after big orchard, disappeared, and we suddenly became a big orchard. We had been kind of lower mid-size in New England before that. And then, and what with our hopes for the cider business, we actually bought some land and planted more bittersweets.
And that's when everyone was like, Steve's crazy. Was like, maybe you'll pull it off.
Talk about leveraging. Anyway, so that, you know, so that was, and it was very hard for a while because, I mean, as the person who's out there kind of pouring and explaining, I can remember people getting furious, you know. The word cider to them meant a nice brown juice that you get in the fall and there's a donut somewhere around there. You know, that's what they
like,
were ready for.
I like donuts.
And you have to get the, yeah, well, donuts, I'm sorry. Well, it might work. I don't know, Jimmy, it might work. But so you get these people going, young woman, this is not cider. And of course, you have to find a tactful way to say, so you never had a passport, huh? Because it, you know, it is, because it is cider in the rest of the world. And the only reason we don't know about that is that we had our little prohibition problem, which cut us off from our tradition.
Let's go back to that. America, great cider country.
Great cider country.
And then, Field, you were telling me about what happened around the time of the Civil War.
Oh, that
going way
basically
back.
In the way that, that these, you know, the sort of...
Back when Steve was in college.
Oh, come now.
no, he was already graduated from college by then.
You guys are so funny.
Basically, cider was a number one drink of colonial America and really America up until around the Civil War. And then beer surpassed it. I'm talking about in terms of gallons consumed nationally, you know. And what that was showing a larger picture of sort of changing America, which is, you know, people were moving to the cities and manufacturing was coming and we were becoming largely urban and largely manufacturing rather than being sort of homesteaders in the country with a few apple trees and people need some booze, they use what's at hand and make this drink. And it was also, I think, just in terms of immigration patterns, the early flood of people working the factory were often German immigrants who brought beer making. So then beer making really flourished, and cider kept going, but it was sort of on a, you know, becoming less and less, you know, prevalent over the. But definitely in apple country where they live and where we live, it was there. But even then, you know, it got, so farmers sort of go-to drink was Budweiser rather than cider. And
Mr. Anheuser figured out how to make refrigerated railway cars too, which had a lot to do with shipping beer around. I mean, he was a technical innovator too, so there was a lot of market forces at work.
Yeah.
But I have to say, in every house over a certain age that you go into in New England, you go downstairs, and if they haven't cleaned it out, there's a barrel or two there.
Yep.
Ours certainly had one in it, you know. So people were still making it for themselves and their friends.
In apple country.
Yeah, well, it didn't travel.
Even, you know, a lot of homes even built in 1900, they mm-hmm. came with an apple and a pear tree in the backyard,
mm-hmm.
which is where I grew up in Massachusetts,
yeah.
too. Hey, so tell us again. This is the extra dry cider.
This is the extra dry cider.
So what do you guys... You have all these crazy apple trees up there in Farmville.
They're not crazy. They just they were just unusual when we planted them, but they make perfect sense in the context they came from. And the thing we did, which hadn't been done before, was to plant a lot of apples that were good for nothing but cider, the way certain wine grapes are good for nothing but grapes.
And the delicious tannins you get in this cider right here is the flower of that in terms of...
You want to join our marketing department, which doesn't exist? You anytime.
Well, tell us the taste of this field. So it's this good tannins.
Yep. And it has a sort of sturdy quality and a kind of complexity that's hard to get. In fact, impossible to get without these so-called bittersweets and bittersharp apples, which are, when you bite into them, they tend to be dry and mealy because the juice is very concentrated, and they tend to be extremely bitter. So it's really quite disturbing, even though, for example, a bittersweet has much higher sugar than a Red Delicious. When you bite it, what you get is this face full of bitterness, so you can't even find the sugar. And the bittersharps, have high tannins and very high acid, which is very important not only for flavor balance but for clean fermentation. And those, of course, okay, combine, you know, the bitterness of a tea leaf with the acids of a lemon, and definitely it's not pleasant. You know, don't make a pie. So but those are critical if you want a really balanced, complex, and also kind of durable cider, because another aspect of tannins is that they help preserve the stuff.
As my friend Ray Dieter from DBA Bar used to say, drink good stuff, and American fine cider is good stuff. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This is a special Cider Sessions show. I'm with Louisa Spencer of Farnham Hill and Phil Maloney of West County. Finally, two ciders in. I can remember their names and talk clearly. But this is, basically, this is a Sunday morning in April. I'm having cider for breakfast, which is one of my favorite things to do. And we're talking about the American fine cider movement. So Lulu, keep going through the list. You mentioned...
Okay. So we did the
Eden.
So we're now down to Foggy Ridge, which is in Western Virginia, in hill country, and she has the steepest orchards I have ever seen.
I always wanted to go.
I'm thinking her tractors must roll all the time. Anyway, Diane Flint is the entrepreneur here. She had an earlier business life, but she did.
First cider maker in the South.
Oh, she?
Yep.
Oh, okay. Good for you. I didn't know. She's just a fabulous figure, and her ciders are largely based on cider apples of that region. She found the ones with cider reputations, and she propagated those. And she
like Harrison's and Granny Winkle. And
well, see, good. Thank you for remembering all that, because all I know is the general part. And I think she
planted some of her sticks.
Oh, good.
Up in Corrine.
Well, see, I hope they're all right.
They're doing good.
Oh, good.
So you guys are talking sticks. You trading sticks and
because they're called scions formally, you know. And the thing about these sticks is that the first thing you do with them is you graft them onto a tree you already have.
Don't you love that sound of the side of corn on the radio?
I don't know. I haven't heard it.
Keep going.
Anyway, so basically when we say sticks, we're talking about the suckers that we cut off any given tree. They have a whole column of buds on them. If you're making trees out of them, each bud becomes a tree. And we generally send that to specialist nurseries to do.
You're missing it. Lulu talks with her hands, so she can't toast and talk at the same time.
No, I certainly can't. What I was interested in when Field said that he had planted some of her Virginia apples is that they're going to have, what, 3 or 4 weeks more of winter with mm-hmm. you at mm-hmm. least mm-hmm. and a correspondingly shorter growing mm-hmm. season. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we brought over a lot of English and French apples, you know, which are usually like 5 months, and they're loafing through the growing season, and they're never really going to freeze a whole lot.
And going to England was part of your inspiration, right?
Oh, of course it was. Yeah, that's where the bittersweets and bittersharps were. There weren't any in this country.
But you guys, you and Steve had traveled there?
We have people there. My sister lives over there. We have old friends. You know, it was a pure coincidence that we were over there seeing them, and Steve was looking out the
car windshield. It's like in the 70s or something?
Yeah,
early 80s.
Yeah, long time ago. And he sees these bizarre orchards. He knows they're orchards, but they look all wrong from a fruit grower's point of view in this country, because they have tall, straight stems. They're pruned like witches' brooms. Clearly, you're not sending a picker in there, because there's nowhere to put a ladder. There are animals in there, which, if you're growing for grocery fruit, you don't have sheep grazing in your orchard, because you're using some stuff to make those apples beautiful that sheep don't like, you know? And so so he thought, oh my, what is going on here? So he knocked on the door, and they explained that these were cider orchards. And the way they harvest over there is to shake them down. So they prune with this tall stem that can be shaken by a machine, and the apples will thump to the ground, and then they kind of hoover them up. We don't do that. We have different approaches. But anyway, the point is, though, that's what got him into the subject. And in the following years, he went around and saw every really kind of noticeable cider maker in the whole country, particularly in Somerset, the West Country, and got to know a lot of field managers got to know people who worked for Bulmers and began to understand that there was a world of cider that America had no understanding of. And if you're in the apple business for keeps and you're in New England, you had very few choices. And so he decided to go for broke and plant, you know, the apples that nobody eats. And
so if you say want to define what American Fine Cider Movement is, yeah, which we're making up.
We're making it up.
Is it an English tradition that we would look to?
No, absolutely not. No,
it's an American tradition. No,
exactly, because we're making stuff. We're using it, for example, we use one English apple called Ashmead's Kernel that has no cider history in England at all. But it makes it lends a kind of floral gorgeousness to our ciders that I've never noticed in an English cider. They have a tradition which is, in a way, more limited. This being America is acting typically American. People are making things up and seeing if they work and seeing if people like them. And the old styles that are spoken of, like the New England style, we don't even recognize that. I mean, well, I don't know. What's that?
What does it mean?
You put raisins in or something.
I mean, that's the neat thing about cider is that everything's still being figured out. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's totally new frontier, even for those of us who've been doing it for 30 years.
Right.
It's like, we're sort of learning as we go, and there's so much. It's definitely still this unendingly surprising,
yeah,
and sort of sometimes baffling,
yeah,
sometimes pleasing,
sometimes
vexing,
embarrassing, deeply embarrassing. Yes, the things that go down the drain are not always, you know, not always what we talk about. But yeah, I mean, it's the chemistry of life that you're working with, and life packs a lot of surprises. So, I mean, people say to us all the time, when are you going to make Calvados? And we go, we're going to be dead before we understand how to make cider. Are you kidding? Calvados? You know, because Calvados is distilled cider, and then you put it in a cellar for 12 years, and then hooray. But we're not going to get there. You know, good for any American who does. It's going to take another 25 years at least. Because you have to go at the pace of woody plants and the land and the market, too.
Let's say I had a friend with a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And he loves cider, and I know there's guys doing this now. Uh-huh. And I found a great place somewhere in America that was good for growing cider trees. And I was going to start from scratch.
Uh-huh.
What would I have to go through, and how long would it take before I could actually make and, you know, grow and all this stuff and have decent cider? Is it 5 years, 10 years, 20 years?
I'd say it's. I mean, the thing is, apple growing is hard. Like, Steve is a particularly good, he's one of the best.
But you can hire people.
I guess if you're willing to,
if you've got all the money in the world.
And
I'm assuming, here's a major assumption, and a lot of it gets back to grafting. I'm assuming when you bought this land, there are at least a few old trees on it, old apple trees, because what this allows you to do is to test all kinds of varieties that without having to grow them from scratch. It takes quite a while to grow an apple tree that's going to bear any amount of fruit, because the wood has to develop to the point where the tree is willing to make fruits that it can hold up, you know. And this is mysterious, but it's true. So 5, 6, 7 years from planting a whip, so-called, to getting fruit, at least, and then not much fruit at that. But if you're trying to decide what you're going to plant, what you can do is graft varieties onto your old trees, a little pencil-sized stick.
It's called top working.
Yeah. Well, even, you know, we did one branch at a time just to check them out.
Yeah.
And so you say you've got 50 old trees, and you put 50 different varieties on one branch of each of those old trees. In 2 or 3 years, you're going to get apples off that branch. And you could start making cider in carboys. This is what we did, to find out if there was, you know, any prospects for the stuff. And so you can get a lot of practice in while you're doing that. Meanwhile, in the fields you have open, you can plant rootstocks, because every professional orchard, not only are the trees cloned, but they're usually assembled as well from the rootstocks, which determine the shape and height of the tree. So, and so you figure out what rootstock's going to work in your fields.
And some will bear much quicker, like in years, and some 15.
But hold on, I'm getting there. And then when you decide what you want to plant, your rootstocks are already going, you whack the tops off and put your varieties right on there. And that's how you kind of condense the amount of time it will take you to get a cider orchard going. So theoretically, you could get a cider orchard started in 5 years after testing the varieties, theoretically.
But not producing much, I'd say, till 10.
No, and then you have to, and then you have to wait. In our own case, we had a cider orchard going great guns before we could use or sell all the fruit. And for in the 90s and the aughts,
the 90s are over.
I know, Doc, but we lived it then, and we had more fruit at that time, cider fruit, than we could use, and nobody wanted it. And so in the succeeding years, when suddenly we began to hear that bittersweets were in demand and so on, still it was pretty slow. And then there came a year, and I forget when it was, 2007, 2008, or whenever it was, when we no longer had to let them drop, when they were all picked. And I swear to God, our field manager cried. I think Fitz Campbell cried to see them all out of there at last.
What year was that?
I can't really remember. See, that it's all a blur to me. But it was quite recently. It took a while, and that all depended on the increase in the number of serious cider makers who cared enough to pay the money to get the juice from those apples. That was a sea change.
Yep.
I mean, you and we were waiting for something to happen, but then it did, in fact, happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of wish it had happened 5 years earlier, but it didn't, so what? And so people like Eve's Cidery in upstate New York, you know, she's very young, and they're very young, and they called Steve, and it all happened. He sent them the six, hooray, hooray. And a lot of people now who need bittersweet and bittersharps for their juice are buying it because they know their cider will become more distinctive. And the whole thing is great. And now stage three is that more conventional apple growers are able to plant cider apples with the assurance of being able to sell them.
Yeah, and on that, another member of the American Fine Ciders is Dan Wilson at Slyborough, who is similar to Steve. In that they both grew up working on an orchard and growing traditional apple fruit, but both of them started. Dan not as long as Steve, but you know, has been making cider for a long time at this point. And both grows. You know, he has a big orchard of Macintosh and all that, but also has been growing cider apples and making really nice cider. So that's another. Part of our collective right now,
we didn't get Foggy Ridge. Okay, and then after Foggy Ridge is Slyborough, and they have some beautiful stuff. They have and they're showing two ciders at this tasting, which will be over by the time anybody hears this.
But the list, American Fine Ciders, to you guys, it's Eden.
Well,
Eve's,
no, see, that's not
Farm
true.
Hill, we Foggy don't, Ridge.
Well, no,
West County.
No, we
Slyborough.
Just happen to be the people of this. In this spirit, who happened to
it's
be doing
it's an improvisational
this.
Collective.
Yeah.
Let's
but
call them
there's other fine ciders.
There
there's lots
fine
of other
ciders.
Fine ciders.
A
out
lot
there.
Of them are on the West Coast, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, like Easy Orchards, fabulous stuff. And what he does is like trapeze work. He depends on wild yeast, you know? And it's never gone wrong for him. We don't do that. We wouldn't dare do that. You know, so everybody's
wild
got different approaches. And there's some gorgeous ciders being made outside the range for which we can, you know, get people involved.
But it's okay for you guys to just say who's in your group. Because
it's
a group of friends, and you kind of have a similar philosophy of what cider should be. And that's okay because, first of all, our consumers and our restaurant and bar friends want to know what are the best ciders to buy and serve.
Yes.
And it's okay for you guys to think about putting a label on it or an association.
It is, I guess, but what we
don't
want to do...
Because if you don't, nobody's going to know that I'm drinking West County and Farm Hill right now. And between you and me, those are about the only two ciders I drink every day because they're so good.
Okay, well, then they're...
Maybe I have to endorse it.
Maybe you'll be president sometime, Jimmy, if you keep it up. But here's our problem. There are new cider makers coming on the scene all the time. We don't want to set ourselves up as judges. What we know is, though, the people who are as serious as we are and as land-based as we are and as, like, OCD as we are, a lot of them make ciders that aren't very good anyway. So that's a problem. So we can call them orchard ciders and grower cider all day, and they may not be very good. On the other hand, there are all kinds of people coming into it that we may not know, or they may be too far away, or, you know, that we're just not involved with, and they may be making gorgeous, gorgeous stuff. So what we don't want to say is we're on a list and you're not. We don't want to say that. What we want to say is that there
just
is
a group of friends that are making cider that we believe in, and we're trying to get the word out,
right.
I think, partly on the kind of cider that we're making, and it's not.
Yeah.
I think that group of friends can expand, or it's
not.
But it's basically it's more of an improvisational project than some fixed thing, and it's kind of we're trying to get the word out on the possible complexity.
Like-minded people making cider.
Yeah.
And we want the trade to understand that even though we don't have big promotional budgets and we don't have terrific designers and logos and billboards, that we exist. Because there's so much noise in cider world now that we could easily just disappear from the understanding of the trade. And everything depends on the wine and beverage professionals who care enough to pay attention, you know? So one of the things in our little tasting is a whole table of what we call debatables.
Which is
stuff that, you know, is either yucky or a matter of taste, like reductive cider, acetic cider, heavily sugared cider. We have a whole
oxidative,
and we have, you know.
So you're developing like
a little academy. And people, you know, if people come through the door from whatever restaurant they work for and decide they love these things, good. That's fine. It's up to them what they like and don't like. We want them to know.
We're running tight on time, so tell us about this other West County.
Oh, the ginger gold. Here. Can I just have a splash?
See, we would never dare make a cider out of ginger gold.
See, yeah, that's
the
thing.
This guy's insane.
Ginger gold, I brought two of our fruit that's sort of...
iffy.
It's conventional cider. People don't consider the ginger gold a cider apple. I think that it has this lovely... sort of... It surprised me.
God, this is great. What's the ABV on it?
I kind of get a kick out of making ciders out
it's
of apples that might get overlooked. And I think ginger gold is one of them. Like,
this is weird. Okay, I'm going to try to make Steve try this just to copy you.
It's sort of like just a modern apple. It was probably the ginger gold apple. There's no ginger in this. It's just the apple's called ginger gold.
It's named after the guy's wife.
Ginger, so this is like an apple that was bred in like the 70s. People are still breeding all, it's like
it's
the Honeycrisp was bred in the 90s. So this is one of those modern, but I made a cider from it and I was like, oh, I like this. This is good.
Yeah, it is good. Yeah, shockingly.
Right. Hey, this has been a really cool show. We've talked about a lot of things, especially American fine cider. I'm urging you guys to, put a brand on that and... we'll talk more about that in future shows.
Well.
You'll be listening to the show sometime in April and May of 2015. In closing, I'd like to thank our sponsors at Union Beer Distributors who have helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. Thanks to Lulu and Phil for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Justin and Maggie. And also to Gay Howard of United States of Cider, who's been helping me set up a lot of these great cider shows. And to our engineer, Jack Inslee, who's going to take this and clean it up and make it a show. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thank you,
Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.